From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Baghdad blogger, we talk with Salam Pax about his now famous weblog in which he described day-to-day life in Baghdad just before, during, and after the war. Because he was critical of Saddam Hussein, he kept his real identity secret, and he continues to do so. But the British paper The Guardian was able to track him down and publish some of his work, and now his weblog is about to be published in book form. Before we talk with Salam Pax, we'll meet Ian Katz, the editor at The Guardian, who helped locate Salam Pax and verify his identity. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Triangle, The Fire That Changed America, by David Vondrelli. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Hurricane Isabel is bearing down on North Carolina, lashing the state from the Outer Banks to Research Triangle Park. Scott Sullivan of the National Weather Service says the biggest danger to inland areas is likely to be rain.
As it moves further inland, at least the winds will gradually subside, but the main threat will actually become more of a rain threat, heavy rain and flash flooding. And to the east of the storm there, you still couldn't rule out the potential of some isolated tornadoes.
The storm has already knocked out power to thousands of people in North Carolina, Virginia, and Maryland. Leonita Inge from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, reports.
Thousands of people on North Carolina's coast are in the dark. John Silver of Roanoke Island is one of them. He chose to stay home and watch the storm come in.
All the trees in my yard were leaning over. They were like dancers. They were doing toe touches.
There are more than 80,000 households without power in eastern North Carolina. Isabel's heavy rain and strong wind is also causing major outages in the central part of the state. Close to 100,000 households are powerless in the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill region. It may take a while to restore power. Utility company officials say they can't put their workers in an unsafe environment and may have to wait until the hurricane blows over before returning to work. For NPR News, I'm Leonita Inge in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
U.S. military officials in Iraq say three American soldiers have been killed and two wounded in an ambush outside of Tikrit. An Army spokesman said the three soldiers from the 4th Infantry Division were killed by small arms fire in a village just south of Tikrit as they investigated a site suspected of being used to launch rocket-propelled grenades. It wasn't clear whether any Iraqis were killed in the firefight. President Bush says the Palestinian people must have a leader totally committed to ending violence before there can be peace in the region. He spoke to reporters after a meeting with Jordan's King Abdullah. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The president told reporters that former Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas had made a good-faith effort to pursue the peace process, but had been undercut at every step of the way by the old order. By that, the president said, he meant Yasser Arafat. Mr. Bush called Arafat a failed leader and said peace efforts had stalled because of the continued violence in the region.
The first thing that must happen is an absolute condemnation and defeat of those forces who will kill innocent people in order to stop a peace process from going forward.
Abbas resigned his position earlier this month, citing differences with Arafat, but also insufficient support from Israel and the United States. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 113 points, or 1.2%, to close at 96.59. This is NPR News. President Bush said today that he doubts that his administration will reach agreement on a new UN resolution on Iraq before he addresses the United Nations General Assembly next week. The U.S. has circulated a draft of a resolution that would authorize a multinational force in Iraq under U.S. command. The idea is to encourage other nations to provide soldiers and aid in the stabilization of Iraq. So far, France and Germany have said they want the resolution to give the UN a bigger role in Iraq's reconstruction and transfer power to an Iraqi government as quickly as possible. The board of AOL Time Warner has voted to remove AOL from the company's name. The media conglomerate will be called Time Warner Incorporated. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
The change will be phased in over several weeks. A statement from the company's chief executive officer says the new name better reflects the portfolio of Time Warner's valuable businesses. AOL's lower profile reflects the troubles the media conglomerate faces with its internet division. In addition to a regulatory probe into its accounting practices, AOL is losing subscribers to competing internet providers. At the time the merger of America Online and Time Warner was announced in early 2000, it was hyped as the beginning of a revolution that would marry old and new media companies, but that expectation has fizzled. Nearly 4 years later, Time Warner seems focused on simplifying, paying down debt, and selling off businesses. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the NASDAQ gained 26 points, or 1.4%, to close at 1,909. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Ace Group, Global Insurance and Reinsurance. Protection. It's not the end, it's the beginning. Continue. On the web at acelimited.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you want to know how the internet has changed the flow of information during war, consider the story of my guest, Salam Pax. Since a few months before the start of the war in Iraq, he's kept an internet weblog, a blog, of his experiences and observations in Baghdad. He didn't expect many people to read it, but he was wrong. It was mentioned in news reports and caught on in places around the world. Since he was criticizing Saddam Hussein's regime, he couldn't use his real name, so he wrote under the pen name Salam Pax, combining the Arabic and Latin words for peace. His love of Western pop culture led some readers to wonder if he was truly an Iraqi. But the British paper, The Guardian, tracked him down in Baghdad and, with his permission, started printing his pieces in the paper. Now his blogs are about to be published in book form in the U.S. under the title Salam Pax, The Clandestine Diaries of an Ordinary Iraqi. Salam Pax is in London this week doing publicity for his book. Before we meet him, let's talk with Ian Katz, the features editor at The Guardian, who brought Salam Pax's weblog to his paper. How did you find out about Salam's blog?
Well, I actually came to it quite late. A couple of my colleagues had been reading it fairly regularly. And a couple of days, probably 2 or 3 days before the war, one of them sent me a whole chunk of it and said, you just have to read this. And I sat down and read it. And it was this extraordinarily compelling account of life in Baghdad in the run-up to the bombing, of all the detailed preparations that people were making, of the changing cost of a ride to the Syrian border, of people bringing down the shutters on their shops. And it was just the most compelling thing I'd read on Iraq in the whole run-up to the war. So I then went, looked at the website and sat down for probably 2 or 3 hours and virtually read the whole thing.
How did his reports compare to what your reporters were saying about what was going on in Iraq?
Well, I think there were 2 or 3 things that were instantly striking. The first was that here was an Iraqi who was plainly telling it exactly as he saw it. I mean, I've reported from Iraq a few times myself in the past, and in fact come away more than once after a week or two in Baghdad thinking that I didn't have a clue what people thought, because they're speaking in such incredibly difficult circumstances. I mean, you know, until we often forget that until the war, any Western journalist, any journalist working in Baghdad was working with a Mukhabarat minder, and so no one in the right mind was going to say exactly what they thought. And suddenly you picked up this blog, and here was Salam describing things that you wouldn't imagine any Iraqi talking about. I mean, I remember reading about him at one point saying that he'd just heard that there were going to be presidential elections and saying, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Just the sort of comment you wouldn't get in a report from a Western correspondent in Baghdad. I remember another where he talked about noticing that ditches had been dug around the city and speculating that the regime was likely to burn oil in them to create a sort of smokescreen, something that actually did happen later in the war. Well, you know, there's no way any Iraqi would have talked to you about that and would have talked to a Western journalist, because it would have been suicidal to do so. So the first thing that was really striking was that you had someone speaking very, very freely, and being in quite a thinly veiled way critical of the regime. And I'd say the other thing that struck me instantly was that Salam was clearly a type of Iraqi who we'd had very little exposure to. One slightly felt reading the reporting, that however good the reporting, that Iraqis tended to be kind of pigeonholed as or tended to be depicted as kind of slightly hysterical, rather desperate, always fearful, never kind of lighthearted, funny, or sort of Western in their sensibilities. And Salam was all those things. I mean, suddenly you had this Iraqi who one moment was talking about the coming war, the next moment was talking about massive attack and how he wished they'd get on with it and release their next album, who had, you know, he would talk about listening to his Coldplay albums, who would refer to articles in The Economist, who loved The New Yorker. And it just, it was like hearing a voice that was similar to your own, and I think that added to the appeal of it.
So how did you trace Salam Pax's identity? It's something a lot of his readers wanted to do but were incapable of.
Well, the truth is, we got lucky. I think we one of the journalists at The Guardian had actually had contact with Salam before we published the first extracts of his blog, and in fact, we'd asked then if we could write something about him, and Salam had urged him not to. I think feeling that it was one thing to write what you felt on the internet, but that once foreign newspapers started reporting it, it would place him in real danger. So actually, we had held fire the first time. We then didn't hear from him for quite a long time, and no one heard from him because he didn't post on the web for probably at least 6 weeks, I think, during the war. But when he finally did come back at the end of the war and post a kind of catch up on the war, one of the things he mentioned in a very offhand remark was that one of the characters, one of his friends, and one of the regular characters in the blog, who goes by the name of G in the blog, had done some translation work for The Guardian. So what we immediately did was mailed all the Guardian correspondents who'd been in Iraq and said, look at this description, look at this guy G, can you figure out who it is? Because if we can get to G, then we're one step away from Salam. And happily, G was quite a forceful personality who most correspondents in Baghdad remembered. So we got to him pretty quickly. And then happily, Salam agreed to meet us. And we ran an interview with him fairly soon after that.
So were you confident when you met Salam Pax that he really was Salam Pax? I mean, the thing on the internet is you never really know who anyone is if they're, you know, they could say they're somebody and really be somebody else.
Well, I mean, Salam Pax isn't Salam Pax. That's a
well, you know what I mean. I know what I was pending,
sure. I mean,
but, yeah.
what I was confident of, and I was confident of it a long time before I met him. I mean, I only met him physically for the first time about 2 weeks ago when he came to London. But what I was confident of virtually from the off was that, you know, this was someone sitting in Baghdad, because I've spent enough time in Baghdad and read enough about Baghdad to just have a feel that this was someone who was writing about what they were looking at. The level of detail was staggering. And, you know, from what we've seen of the performances of intelligence agencies in recent years, they would be doing a lot better than they have done of late if they'd managed to create something with this level of verisimilitude. So while not knowing exactly who he was, I was satisfied very early on that this was someone writing from Baghdad. And in a way, we felt initially that was enough.
Ian Katz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Ian Katz is the features editor of The Guardian. He wrote the introduction to the new book, Salam Pax, The Clandestine Diaries of an Ordinary Iraqi, and it's the weblog of Salam Pax. And with me now is Salam Pax. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Now that Saddam Hussein is out of power, what can you tell us about who you are? I know you don't want to reveal your name, and frankly, your name wouldn't mean very much to Americans anyway,
yeah.
So we wouldn't be likely to recognize your name. But what can you tell us about your life, your identity? And if you can't tell us much, that's fine, too. I'll leave that to your discretion.
No, I studied architecture. I spent almost, in total, half of my life abroad, but have been in Iraq for the last 7 years. No, it's more like 8 years. My English comes from the time I was abroad. I was in Austria. I started architecture there. I finished it in Iraq. I worked as an architect for a couple of years in Iraq before the war. I was not in Iraq during the first Gulf War. Actually, I was in Austria. And these are, you know, small little memories about that and how it happened and when we first got back to Iraq. So, I mean, that's basically it. I mean, yeah.
And how old are you?
I'm 30. I'm going to be 30 in a couple of days.
During the war, what did you think the risks were if your identity was discovered?
I'd be hanging from a ceiling somewhere. It's you know, what happened at the first week of the war, you know, these satellite phones, they were tracking people down who were communicating through these satellite phones, putting them on TV, calling them traitors, and you know they're going to get executed. They basically were going after every single person who was in a way giving information to the outside world, saying what's happening, because, you know, they're going into war and every bit of information might be of some importance. I didn't realize that right at the beginning. I was writing, there is this 1 week at the beginning of the war where the internet did not go down, where we still had internet, and I was posting. And I was writing about all the places I was going to, what I saw there, what the bombing was like. And then I saw that on TV, and I'm thinking, this is not good. I was seriously worried. And besides, there was on BBC World Service and Voice of America a report about the weblog. And that was actually the scariest time I've ever had. It was this 2 weeks before everything totally fell apart, and I was sure that they're never going to track me down because the internet is down. They're worried about other things. But the first 2 weeks of the war, they were looking for people, and I was really, really worried.
One of the amazing things about your story is that not only did the Saddam Hussein authorities know who you were, your parents didn't know who this web logger was. Your family had no idea that you were that guy. How did you manage to keep it a secret from your own family?
Oh, it's, you know, that's the beauty of, you know, doing things on a computer, on the internet. Nobody has to know anything. You're sitting there and you have, you know, a couple of windows open. One of them is work. One of them is something on the internet. And the other one is the, you know, the blogging site. And yeah, I'd write stuff all the time. And of course, when they found out, my father would go, ah, so this is why you're spending so much time in front of your computer. It's not very difficult. You just don't talk about it. You make sure that you do not talk about it. There is only one friend, Raed. The site is called Where's Raed? And he knew about it. He used to read it all the time. He's in Jordan.
So did your family feel like you had endangered them by writing blog?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. There was a moment of course, they only found out a couple of weeks after the war started, because that's when the BBC thing went on. So, there was a moment where you know that you could have gotten us all in serious trouble. You know that this was very, very dangerous. And we were all just very lucky, which is true, which is very, very, very true. It was very reckless. It was sometimes foolish. It's just you get carried away. There's this space where you can say what you want to say, and you just do it. It's this outlet. You can talk there. People respond to you, and so.
You mentioned in your writing that there were points where you felt like your readers knew more about what you were thinking and feeling than your family did because you were writing all this stuff in your blog.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you weren't telling it to your family and they didn't know that the blog was written by you.
No, I mean, they didn't even read it. They didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, blogging in general, I've been reading all these people for a very long time before I started blogging, and they'd put all these things about their lives, and it feels like they're sharing with you. They're telling you what's happening with their lives. They're giving you little, very, you know, sometimes intimate glimpses into their lives. And at one point, when I decided I start my own blog, it's you kind of give back some of what they gave you. It was wonderful reading them. It was like you get to know other worlds. And yes, I did put a lot on the weblog, consciously thinking, this, I'm sharing, you know, my little world with all these people from whom I've learned so much, or just, you know, got to see other parts of the world, of other lives through these weblogs. And that's what it was in the beginning. It was really just bloggers. It doesn't feel like you're writing now, like all these people reading the columns and coming online to read the weblog. It was much smaller. You don't feel you're giving too much away, because it's like having a conversation on a really big table where you get a chance to talk and everybody listens and someone else starts talking and you listen. And it was just this big table where everybody was telling stories.
Right, but you felt more exposed once it got into newspapers.
Of course. I mean, some of the stuff, I mean, when I read it now, it's funny to know that all these people would know so much about your life.
My guest is Salam Pax. His now famous weblog about life in Baghdad before, during, and after the war is about to be published in book form in the U.S. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Salam Pax, and he has kept a weblog since a few months before the war in Iraq. He lives in Iraq, and his blog became internationally known. It's now being published in The Guardian, and also there's a book version, which is called Salam Pax, The Clandestine Diaries of an Ordinary Iraqi. Salam, has anyone in your family been hurt in the war or the post-war?
During the war, there was this one incident where our neighborhood got there was on the main street, there was a convoy going by, and we had a couple of Baathists sitting at the end of the street in an empty house, and I think one of them shot something at the convoy. The convoy stops, they go back, and one tank stays, and it shoots something like 20 tank shells towards the block where we live. Luckily, no one got hurt, but this was actually, it was after the war, it was after the statue fell. It's very scary having, it's so close, in the end, we had three houses in the block were totally destroyed, one house burned, our house some damage, two girls got hurt, but luckily no one died. It was just a very, very... So this was really the most dangerous time we had. The thing is, we live in a not in the center of Baghdad. We live, quite a bit far away from the center. There is nothing near us. And what we did is that we got all the family to come over to where we live. At one point, I think we had something like, 25 people living in our house, because it was pretty safe. There was nothing around it, so we'd just go and check on friends and relatives and places where it was they did get bombed, but we were lucky. We were really lucky there.
And do you have a lot of friends or family who lost their homes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, during the beginning of the war, the especially in Baghdad, the air raids. You would be amazed just how, precision bombing is just scarily precise. It's just incredibly precise. And as long as you don't live near one of the government buildings or Saddam's palaces, which nobody does anyway, you are actually very safe. I mean, stay in your house, don't go out. We were worried more about the Iraqis than the bombers, you know. Okay, there'll be stray bombs going here and there, and they'd get false information. But it's actually the bombing part of the war was pretty... It wasn't as frightening as the time when the actual troops were coming into Baghdad.
What made that part more frightening?
You didn't know what will happen. I mean, the first nights of the bombing, of course, this was the same. There was fear, uncertainty. You did not know what is going to happen. When you hear the air raid sirens, your brains just stop functioning. There is just fear. And you keep listening. You just keep listening what's happening. And then you hear them drop somewhere. It's like, boof, big explosion. And then another one comes, and another one comes. The first two nights. And then, you know, next morning, me and my cousin would go and see where the places the bombs dropped and everything and look at them. And you kind of start realizing, no, you actually do. You are not afraid of the, you know, big bombers. You're worried about the Iraqis, the Iraqi army, what it would do. There were all these rumors about getting all the men in the city, you know, to carry weapons and pushing them out to fight. About, you know, lots of uncertainty.
What precautions did you take in your house to protect against the armies and to protect against, you know, possible chemical or biological warfare and to protect against the bombing in case there was a stray bomb?
Yeah, it's this, you know, this was actually part of the good part of the weblog, where people would tell me about, give me tips on things. And for example, everybody was drilling these, you know, wells. It's, the water table in Baghdad is pretty high, so it's not very hard to get, you know, a small well. And everybody was doing this because we were worried that the water would stop at one point. So I went on the weblog and I was telling, you know, people what we were doing and how I, you know, finally convinced my family that we actually need to drill a well. And I got all these responses of people telling me how to make sure that how deep I should go and how to make sure that the water is usable, which is actually very helpful. And then we had to dig, you know, very deep holes in the garden and stock gas and kerosene for the generator. We had to, because all the family was coming over to our house, we had to make, it looks like a bit like a hotel, actually. It was funny at a point.
You called it Hotel Pax in your blog.
Yeah, because there's so many people coming. It was good. You know, it is so good to have so many people around you in difficult situations. It just takes, I mean, lunch becomes a huge production. It's like everybody has to do this and that, and, you know, you have to prepare food for so many people. It gets your mind off things you don't want to think of.
Salaam Pax will be back in the second half of the show. His weblog is about to be published in book form. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader. Available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Daily Life in Baghdad Now, we continue our conversation with Salaam Pax, the Baghdad blogger. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new book about the fire at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory that killed nearly 150 workers in 1911. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Salam Pax. That's the pen name of the architect from Baghdad who has written a weblog on the internet since just before the start of the war, describing daily life in his city. The blog became famous. Even journalists have praised its descriptions. Now the blog is in book form and will be published in the U.S. in a couple of weeks under the title Salam Pax, The Clandestine Diaries of an Ordinary Iraqi. Salam Pax is in London this week doing publicity for the book. Salam, is liberated the right word to describe how your country feels to you now?
Of course. But you see, I mean, when you say liberation, there is with it a feeling that there should be a huge sigh of relief. The problem is, at the moment, we still didn't have this, you know, collective, oh, God, it's over. Because people, it's still difficult. The day will come, I am sure. I mean, there's this one point, there's this one, you know, hour and a half when I'm sure everybody's seen it, that when they were pulling down the statue of Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point, yes, this was the moment, was everybody, we were sitting in front of TV. We didn't have electricity. We had to run the generator because we were getting, you know, someone from the end of the street, a neighbor was going, turn on your TVs, look what's happening. So we turn on the TVs and you see this and you're thinking, oh my God, you know, my aunts were going, no way anybody thought this is going to happen in our lifetime, and we're just totally dumbstruck. This is amazing. Of course, you are optimistic at that point, but things started getting a bit more difficult, and you start to worry. It was just as the troops were moving into Baghdad, and there was still this uncertainty about what was going to happen. Yes, I would say we are freer now, of course, and we are definitely moving on the right way to a truly free, liberated Iraq. It's just going to take a bit of time. We need patience.
What kind of encounters have you been having in your daily life with U.S. soldiers who are stationed in Iraq and trying to keep the peace there?
Oh, all sorts. It's
give us an example of a good and a bad one, if there is
yeah,
such.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a good one would be, right. I think it was the second week when they were in Baghdad, and they weren't very. The Americans weren't sure about the people, and the people in Baghdad weren't sure about the Americans. But then slowly, I'd have, you know, a cousin who went back to his home because it was a bit safer by then, and at the end of his street, the Americans had a, you know, just a small station where a couple of tanks and they were staying there, they weren't so afraid of Iraqis as they are now. He'd come back to me and tell me about, you know, them letting him take a look at the tank inside, and they would come over and actually have lunch at his place. It was at the beginning, the first couple of weeks, you'd hear lots of this, some actual true interaction between the Iraqis and the Americans in Baghdad. It's only later on they withdrew a bit more. There was this fear that things aren't as stable as everybody hopes. And at that point, you'd get your the thing you just called a bad example, because they come over from thousands of miles away. They have no idea what the culture is like. This comes across as hostility. It's maybe just, you know, they just sometimes you get the feeling that they don't know how things go, and they just act the way they see it's normal, but it's sometimes offensive to Iraqis.
Well, can you think of an example that happened to you where you felt that an American or a British soldier misinterpreted a kind of standard thing, because they didn't understand the culture and they responded inappropriately to what they had seen?
During house raids,
What are house raids?
Oh, because they'd raid a whole neighborhood and check for weapons and go into houses, check what is in the house, who is in the house. And they do this throughout. I mean, it was everywhere in Iraq and Baghdad and other governorates that just go into neighborhoods, block them off, and go into houses. So it's, you know, if anything bad is going to happen, it's going to happen there during these raids. It's at night. People are just, suddenly you have someone banging at your door and, you know, they want to go into your house. They don't come with enough translators sometimes, which is a bad thing. So someone comes out who doesn't really speak the language. I mean, both of them, neither the soldier speaks Arabic nor the Iraqi speaks English. And you have them standing at the door. Now the Iraqi has his, for example, daughter and wife sitting in the room just behind the door, just behind him, without hijab, without, you know, their head cover or the abaya. And, I mean, because they do this and you know, these very simple or very religious places, you have to be very careful. So the man outside is trying to explain, do not come in because, you know, my wife, my daughter, whoever, needs to cover herself. I mean, a stranger shouldn't be looking at her if she hasn't covered her hair. It's just, you know, that's the way her belief is. So, of course, he cannot bring this across to the soldier because he doesn't speak English. The soldier doesn't understand this. What he understands is that someone is pushing him away. And so he thinks he doesn't want me into his house. Something is wrong. Down he goes, sack on his head, tie his hand, put a gun on his head, and he, you know, starts shouting at him, things the Iraqi does not understand anyway. Now the women come out and they see their, you know, father or husband down on the ground, and everybody starts wailing and going, and you have a scene. And it creates, you know, lots of tension. It's down to communication. It's down to understanding. This is, you know, lots of it comes down to these things, not being able to understand just simple things. Going into a mosque with your shoes, a big no-no. Just, you don't do it. And sometimes they just go back, 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 and they see them in there. Oh, my God, what are you doing with your shoes on?
Was your house ever raided by soldiers?
Yeah, yeah, it was. It was.
What was your experience like? You speak English, so the translation thing wouldn't be a problem.
No, it was. Yeah, it was. Actually, it was much easier for. I mean, it was scary. I wasn't at home. My mother was actually a bit freaked out. I wasn't at home, so I came back the other day and the next day, and they were telling me, you know, the Americans were here and they've been through the house and everything. Yeah, because everybody was able to talk to everybody else, like my father, my brother, and my mother. It's like everybody was making sure that they understood there is nothing in here. You shouldn't be afraid of anything. There were no problems. It's just the point of being very uncomfortable. I mean, you have 20 people suddenly at 12 o'clock at night climbing over your fence, you know, with guns pointing at you, telling you to come out of your house because you want to look through it. So it's just this point which is a bit uncomfortable. And they wouldn't tell you why or what happened, so what have you done wrong. So no, they just want to do it. And of course, because you're talking to them, the hour they spent there wasn't probably as tough as if it would have been somewhere else. It's not always like this. When they have translators around with them, it's no problem.
My guest is Salam Pax. His now famous weblog about life in Baghdad before, during, and after the war is about to be published in book form in the U.S. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Salam Pax. This is the pen name of an Iraqi who has written a blog, a weblog, since a few months before the start of the war. and he's continuing to write it. He's also writing now for The Guardian in England, and there's a book collecting the entries in his weblog, and that book is called Salam Pax, The Clandestine Diaries of an Ordinary Iraqi. You have one of your entries in your weblog in which you wrote about watching Paul Bremer on the news every night. And you said it was like watching Saddam Hussein, you know, because he's all over. He's always making statements. You said next we'll have statues of him in the streets. And then you added you didn't believe him either. Is there a general feeling now that the American interim administration has problems of credibility and communication problems like the actual Iraqi government did before?
Yeah. They are in their, they call it the green zone, which means, you know, the safe zone. It's the old palace grounds. It's just, you know, it's just, you bring up the wrong associations. You wall yourself in again in the same place. You are not as transparent as everybody was hoping. And sometimes you say things which feel like you're on another planet. It comes down again to communication. They are in this green zone. They're afraid to go out and see people, see what they're doing, see how they're living. They do things. I am sure there is a lot happening. I'm not only sure, I know there's a lot happening, but not things that people feel like they're changing the daily lives with. It's something that's on a much higher level. It's very slow. It takes lots of time. You don't see it, but it's not coming down to them. They're not, nobody's communicating with them. Nobody's telling. The only thing they see is, you know, Bremer on TV talking a foreign language, looking really nice and neat, very clean, and you know, it's just the same images. You end up, you click the channel. We now, at least now, we have satellite TV. We don't have to watch that.
You know, all the reports I've been hearing about life in Iraq now make it sound really anarchic, with lots of crime and still looting. When you go out in the streets, do you do anything to protect yourself or even to arm yourself?
No, you don't arm. But and I mean, it's not as crazy as it was a month after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, businesses are back, banks are back, buses, taxis, the streets are full of cars. Of course, you have these crazy things happening we didn't have before. Like the other day on Karada Street, there was this man, you know, on the street with his, you know, leg just a couple of meters away. And when you ask, they tell you, oh, there was a hand grenade in his pocket. It's like, what's he doing with a hand grenade? Or you'd hear too much shooting at night. But it's not total anarchy anymore. Iraqi police are on the streets. They're replacing the American soldiers we had. Life is a little bit normal. I mean, up to something like 4 p.m., it looks very normal. And then later, you see the streets emptying. People close shops pretty early. We have this 11 o'clock curfew, but you can see the streets are just as empty as anything after 8 p.m.
Do you have any money? Are you working?
Yeah, I mean, look, most...
Well, you probably got money from your book advance, so...
No, look, I mean, personally, the place where I used to... I mean, the architecture place where I used to work in, the consultancy, they're not open again yet. I mean, they're open, but they're doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what most people do. You know, civil servants, government employees, they just go, you know, sit for a couple of hours and go back to their homes. I mean, at least they're getting paid. That's very good, because the first couple of months they were not.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things that are missing. Just a general sense of purpose, that you're doing something with your life. It's just, at the moment, the whole country has come to a standstill. We're kind of living off charity. So it gets to you sometimes, yeah.
No, in your blog, you make it seem like you didn't really want to come back to Iraq to live. You'd been living in Vienna where where you went to school and worked, and you lived there during part of your childhood because your father was working there.
Yeah.
So anyways, you didn't want to come back to Iraq, but you say that your parents really wanted you to come back. Can you talk about why they wanted you to come back and how you felt upon returning?
It's not wanting to come back. It's just when you spend, you know, when you're 15, 16, 17, 18 in one place, you kind of get seriously attached to it. These are the years where, you know, you make your friends, you just... Mm-hmm. So when I first got to Baghdad, it was... I felt just as a stranger. I haven't been there for quite a while, and I was used to other ways. But you kind of rediscover your Iraqiness pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. With a little help from friends, you just get really attached to the place. It's really funny, but I got serious, you know, I really loved the city, Baghdad, because it's different when you spend all your life in a place and then when you go away and come back to it and kind of rediscover all this in a very, because you've seen something else and, you know, kind of now you can appreciate what you had much more. And it's just very different. It is very different. It's not perfect. It's not something that, there are lots of things I don't approve of that I would wish were different, but you kind of, you know, this is my city. It grows on you in ways which just totally, you get very attached to it.
If President Bush came to you, if you knew what you knew now and you were able to turn back the clock, and President Bush came to you and said, well, should we go into Iraq or not?
Oh, God, that's a difficult question.
Yeah, what would you have told him?
Be a little bit more patient. Don't run into it like you did. Iraqis know that they need foreign intervention to get rid of Saddam, but we also need to feel that it's not about... and we need to feel it's that more of an effort the world wants to do to get, you know, rid of that bad regime. The way it was done gives just too much chance to people to come and say, look, this is just American imperialism. Look what they're doing. You're giving a chance for the, you know, bad people to say bad things. You're giving them so much chance to do that.
You were reluctant to return to Iraq from Vienna. Is this the place you want to be now?
I'm almost talking to my friend Raed, who is now in Baghdad, every day. And I just cannot wait until they let me loose here and I just go back to Baghdad. I just miss the place so much.
But you're talking to us from London now.
And
you're in London because your new book, which collects
your
blog
out
entries,
of
has come out. Yeah. So, yeah. And you're writing for The Guardian now. That you're keeping a blog for them. You probably could have a life in England or the United States, but you prefer to go back to
Baghdad. No. How can you leave a place which is first your country, mm-hmm. and second going through this very important turn. You know, this is now something that history will forever, you know, talk about in your country. And this, you are so lucky to be part of it. You can be part of it. You can, you know, do something amazing now and see it happen, see it develop. Of course I have to be there. Of course I have to be there.
Salam Pax, thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Salam Pax's weblog about life in Baghdad before, during, and after the war is about to be published in book form in the U.S. under the title Salam Pax. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire that killed nearly 150 workers in 1911. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. On the afternoon of Saturday, March 25, 1911, a fire broke out at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, located just off Washington Square in Manhattan. 146 workers died, almost all of them young Jewish and Italian immigrant women. Until September 11th, the Triangle Fire was the deadliest workplace disaster in the history of New York City. Washington Post reporter David Von Draeli has written a new book about the tragedy, which he says was a catalyst for change in America well beyond important workplace reforms. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
In the prologue to his superb book, Triangle, David Von Draeli takes readers to a pier in Manhattan known as Misery Lane. There, on March 26, 1911, some 100,000 people lined up to walk into a makeshift morgue and view the bodies of 146 workers who had died the day before in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, a fire that had started in a scrap garment bin. Some of the onlookers at the pier were sobbing relatives of the dead, who identified their loved ones by a plait of braided hair or a shoe insert that mysteriously escaped the flames. Most of the others present were voyeurs, some even chewing gum and giggling. A police official, outraged by their behavior, finally ordered the viewing line purged of these ghouls. The danger of a book like Triangle is that we readers step into the place of the gawkers, vicariously thrilling, for instance, to the spectacle of young women leaping to their deaths from the windows of the factory. Like the Titanic disaster that took place a year later, the Triangle Fire contains all the melodrama needed to make a blockbuster Hollywood weepy. So it's part of the triumph of Von Draeli's book that while paying homage to the dead and the terror of their last moments in that burning factory, he also successfully urges us to look beyond the fire, which lasted a scant half hour, to the larger political and social world the Triangle workers inhabited. In detailed yet readable fashion, Von Draeli ambitiously traces how, because of the Triangle Fire, the burgeoning women's rights movement, the labor movement, and the progressive movement all joined forces for a remarkable time in American history, transforming the Democratic Party and clearing the way for the New Deal liberalism of Franklin Roosevelt. Triangle is such a rich book and such gripping narrative history that listing all the topics and colorful personalities gracing its pages would do it a disservice. Let's just say that if you want a short but substantive history of sweatshops or Tammany Hall, a background on the gender politics underlying the invention of the shirtwaist, or an understanding of why the 1909 general strike garnered an unprecedented coalition of female factory workers, women's college graduates, Lower East Side socialists, and progressive high society matrons, this is the book to read. Maybe I'm predisposed, as the daughter of a lifetime union shop steward, to be moved by Von Draeli's account of the 1909 general strike, begun when thousands of young female factory workers gathered at a meeting hall at Cooper Union in Manhattan, raised their right hands, and pledged to struggle until the end. But conversely, I think you'd have to be a latter-day Simon Legree not to be touched by this all-too-forgotten story of working-class women standing fast against a hostile police force, hired goons, and even neighborhood priests who preached to the Italian girls among the strikers that striking was a sin. Two of the bosses who mounted the most violent resistance to the strike were the owners of the Triangle Factory, Max Blank and Isaac Harris, themselves Jewish immigrants like many of the workers who were beat up by their goons. Von Draeli says that blood then was already the Triangle's legacy, even before history paid another visit in the form of the fire. Blank and Harris would later be accused of causing workers' deaths by blocking a vital exit door to guard against employee theft. They were acquitted despite damning evidence to the contrary. Figures like Al Smith and Francis Perkins were so outraged by the verdict, they worked to usher in a new era of political and labor reform. At the center of his book, Vondrejli retells the story of the fire and goes into detail for the first time about the lives of some of the women workers who died. One surviving Triangle employee Vondrejli quotes recalls that, "We used to have a lot of fun working together at the factory, all young girls." The pathos of the Triangle fire is so embedded in the story, Vondrejli wisely recognizes that he doesn't have to underscore it. With restraint and intelligence, he makes good on the claim of his subtitle, that Triangle really was the fire that changed America, and changed, at least for a time, the way Americans regarded the dignity of ordinary workers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Triangle, The Fire That Changed America, by David Vondrejli. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, paperback publishers of the new novel Caramello by Sandra Cisneros, author of The House on Mango Street. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back in time. Someone said try some. I tried some, now buy some. I bought some. Ooh.
David Bowie has a new CD on the next Fresh Air. We talk with him about his life and music. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.